Okay, let's go ahead and get started. Dr. David just made my task easier. She requested that I not use her bio because she's going to talk about it in her own way. But I have to say a couple of things. Dr. David is part of the latest group of S&T leaders within the U.S. who have been made part of the National Science Board. And in that capacity, she's one of about 15 to 20 leaders, science and technology leaders within the U.S. that informed the President of the United States and the Congress with regard to science and technology priorities and policies within the U.S. She's a graduate of Wichita State, as well as Stanford. She is, of course, selfishly speaking, been a member of the advisory board of the School of Systems and Enterprises for 7 or 8 years now, and is our current chair. She also helps us by being on the advisory board of the Systems Engineering Research Center. I couldn't even tell you how many boards she's on. I think she's very much in demand, whether it's within the intelligence community or beyond in the financial services community. She, to me, is a role model in somebody who is not only good at what they do, but gives enough of her time to cause a change in the way society in general views science and technology, and does her share in causing the right kind of priorities to be in place within the U.S. when we look at science and technology. So with that, I'll introduce Dr.
There's Ruth just Davis. No way to live up to that, Dinesh. Thanks very much. I mean that seriously. That's really vastly overstates my influence. I wanted to, first of all, thanks for inviting me here. It's always fun to talk to groups like this, and I hope we have a chance to engage. If you have questions, raise your hand. We'll get mics to you, because I would like to keep this very informal. I wanted to start with an assertion. I believe that engineering and leadership have some things in common. Bill Wolf, who was the former president of the National Academy of Engineering, said his favorite definition of engineering is design under constraint. I would argue it's pretty much what leadership is about. It's about figuring out what you're trying to accomplish and figuring out how to get there and what the constraints are. Now, the messiness comes in that the constraints are really quite different, and the components that you have to build it with are really quite different. But the theory seems right. The other thing that they have in common, though, is you don't learn either one in a textbook. Now, I'm not dismissing education. Don't misread that. Textbook learning education is very important in both areas, as is lifelong learning. But both engineering and leadership, in my view, are a contact sport. You got to get out and do it, because that's how you really learn. Now, confession. I like the Yogi Berra phrase, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. That's pretty much the random walk that my career has been. I didn't start out planning to be either an engineer or an executive. That wasn't even in my frame of reference. I grew up on a farm outside a town, population 200, if you counted the cats and dogs, in Kansas. I went to 12 grades of school in one building. I went from there to a community college because they offered me a $50 a semester scholarship, and that covered tuition. I worked as a bookkeeper in a lumber yard to cover my room and board. So this is not an exposure to career counseling, shall we say. I actually started college intending to be a math teacher. By the time I got to, I'll say, junior in high school, I had concluded that I wanted to teach in college because surely math students in college at least liked the subject. And in my experience, high school students hated math. So that was my plan. I was going to major in math, go on for advanced degrees, and teach in college. By early in my sophomore year, I was pretty bored with calculus and differential equations. And my physics professor hooked me up with a recruiter from Wichita State University who lured me into electrical engineering with the promise of a full scholarship and a job in the dean's office. I said, sounds like a deal. I have no idea what engineers do, but I'll give it a shot. And I owe him a debt of gratitude. That was a real turning point in my career. I will never forget, though, going and telling my boss at the lumberyard that I had switched my major and I was going to become an engineer. He said, why would you want to drive a train? And unfortunately, I didn't know enough about engineers. I was pretty sure I wasn't going to drive a train. But that was, I mean, career counseling was not something that was commonplace. Let's see, that was many, many decades ago, though, so things have changed, fortunately. So I went to Wichita State and there had some interesting experiences. I did manage to complete a bachelor's in the remaining 2 years. Took a lot of hours to do that, but I had I had a professor who made the mistake of saying you can't do it, and so I had to prove him wrong, and I did it. But my intent, because I didn't feel like 2 years of engineering courses was anywhere near enough, I had another professor who encouraged me to apply to Stanford for a fellowship, which I did, and so my intent was to go directly from WSU to Stanford to get a master's degree before I even thought about looking for a job. Well, life intervened again. I took one interview at the request of the dean. It was with Southwest Bell. The lady gave my application to Bell Labs, who gave it to Sandia Labs. Bell Labs was at that time operating Sandia Labs. And for those of you who have never heard of it, it's a nuclear weapons engineering laboratory in Albuquerque, New Mexico, headquartered, and also in Livermore, California. So I got a call out of the blue. I'd never heard of Sandia, never been to Albuquerque. They invited me to come down for an interview, and I said, well, I'm really not looking for a job. I want to go on and get a master's degree. Turns out that they had mimicked Bell Labs, and they have what they called the one-year on-campus program, where they hire you, put you to work for the summer, and then ship you off to graduate school. And they pay all the tuition and a stipend, and the stipend was more generous than the fellowship. And so my question, I'm amazed that they brought me down for an interview, my question was, what's my obligation? Being a good negotiator, they said, there is no obligation. I said, you mean you don't own me for 5 years or something? I said, no. So I went down for an interview and was fortunately selected for that program. Went off to Stanford that fall and completed my master's degree. Went back to the lab thinking, I know nothing about the programs here, but it looks like it's going to be a good place to learn. And I literally, and this is another of those strange forks, I literally got into town in Albuquerque on a Friday, rented an apartment on Saturday. Monday, my boss said, we're sending a few people to Florida to oversee a project that's really in trouble. Would you like to go? I said, sure, why not? So I said, can you get me out of my lease? He said, sure. So I was in Albuquerque for about a week, and then shipped with colleagues I didn't know to Florida to go into a manufacturing facility or an engineering facility and play overseers to some very, very experienced engineers who were building a system for Sandia, and they were probably about three times the budget and three times the time, and severely underrunning on performance. It was literally in very, very serious trouble. And so we were sent down to make a decision, basically, to say, can this system be made to work? Can it be salvaged? Here I am, brand new, young female, newly minted master's degree, knowing nothing about real life engineering. And I'm in a role of overseeing these very, very experienced engineers. That was lesson number one. Trust has to be earned. And it being thrown into that environment was a bit of a trial by fire, but it taught me very, very early that first you build relationships, because if you're working with them and you expect candor, which we desperately needed, to understand what was going on. If you expect candor and openness, you've got to earn their trust and their respect. And that means, it was pretty easy for me to be humble because I didn't know much. But it was it really set that lesson in me right from the start. The other lesson that followed right on its heels, though, was leadership is sometimes about being a teacher, sometimes about being a student. What do I mean by that? Well, it turns out that the engineers, the team of engineers working on this system, well, first of all, let me back up. The system itself was a first ever completely digital data acquisition system. Bear with me. This was the mid-70s, so it's been a long time. First ever completely digital microprocessor-based control system that was to be fielded at the Nevada test site in an underground nuclear effects test. Now, what that means is this was not a friendly environment for the system, so it imposed a whole lot of constraints on the design. It was complex because we wanted to control it from 10 miles away as opposed to being close to where the bomb went off. So it had a lot of system attributes that made it a real challenge. But the other thing that was very interesting, and what the team of engineers that I was working with, what we discovered is the people doing the final stage development and buildup of this system were largely analog engineers. These were very, very good, very experienced people, but they didn't know digital systems. And so we would find them trying to test a digital data bus with an oscilloscope. Now, probably not many have seen oscilloscopes, but trust me, that's a really bad idea. It's just a really bad idea. So I found myself, even though I was very inexperienced by comparison, I found myself showing them and actually writing test code and those sorts of things in partnership with them, while at the same time I was their student, because they knew more about mechanical and the other aspects of engineering than I did. So it was a very, very interesting situation to be in when, in theory, I was the enemy. I was an overseer. But in practice, we built a rapport that said, look, we just need to get this thing to work. And so it was really about building the kind of collective effort to move the system forward. We ended up actually taking the system back to Albuquerque before it was fully functioning, but we concluded that it had gone as far as it could in that environment, and the rest of my team and I were taking bets on how could we get the truck driver to drive it off the cliff somewhere, because we weren't really sure we wanted it to arrive safely in Albuquerque. But it did. And we actually fielded it downstream. There was another, though, for me, there was another important lesson that has stuck with me for many years, which is leaders shouldn't set people up to fail. And in my view, the management of this facility set these people up for failure. And I think that's just dead wrong. They didn't have the skills. No fault of their own. They simply didn't have the skills to do the job that needed to be done. And I think that's tragic. Unfortunately, it's not entirely uncommon. I've seen it in other situations since. A belief that even though the job changes very dramatically, we need to use the people we have without either sufficient retooling, re-education, or affording them different kinds of opportunities. So that's something that really has stuck with me. And I think in challenging times like are being faced in many industries today, when you're faced with downsizing in some regards, there's a desire to say, well, I've got these people, I can get it done. But I think, in my view, a good leader steps back and says, am I setting them up for failure? Because that is a disservice to everyone. So that relatively brief experience very early in my career taught me quite a lot. From there, I mentioned fielding underground nuclear effects tests in the Nevada test site. This was, I'm a little weird. This was a wonderful way to grow up as an engineer. Wonderful way to grow up as an engineer. Why do I say that? Well, first of all, we were doing things that had never been done. That was exciting. Secondly, I discovered that the fact of a nuclear effects test schedule is a real motivator for teamwork. Because when the bomb goes boom, you can't say, oops, let's try that again. There is no do-over. There is no do-over. These are very, very long planned and scheduled events. And if your system, and we were responsible with our system for 128 channels of data, that meant on average 15 or 20 experimenters whose data we were safeguarding, if our system failed, they didn't have data. I mean, that's a lot of responsibility. So you did dry runs, you did every imaginable kind of testing in that environment. And we literally, in that first test, because the system was so unstable, fragile, call it what you will, we literally had people working 12-hour shifts around the clock just to test things out and to try to make sure that we had found as many of the issues as possible. In the aftermath, we joked that our first good dry run was on test day. It worked. It worked. But we immediately shipped it home and junked it and started over because we knew that we couldn't patch that anymore. But we learned so much from that system that we went into a new design phase, and this time we didn't ship it off to someone in Florida to build for us. We actually held it much closer to home and built replacement systems and replicated them and continued advancing them. But I learned so much from everything from Sandia was a very degree conscious environment. So the fact that I had advanced degrees mattered a lot, and I would get project manager titles, project lead titles, when my team had far more depth of knowledge and experience. So it goes back sometimes teacher, sometimes student. And the importance of building a rapport and being able to lead while still learning. And I think that's something that every position I've held throughout my career, I've realized that any leader will not be the subject matter expert on everything. You simply cannot. So you always have to be open and welcoming to learning from your team and from others throughout your career. I mean, that's just vital in my frame of mind. So it was, Sandia was a great place. After thinking I wouldn't stay there very long, I actually spent 20 years at the lab, but I held a lot of different positions in that 20 years. I moved into other kinds of facilities operation. At one point, I was managing our missile launch range in Kauai, Hawaii, which is great fun. But I also then had what I fondly called my 525 square mile environmental restoration zone, which was the Tonopah test range that had many decades of environmental hazard contamination, and that was part of my testing machinery. My last position that I held, next to last, I took over all of Sandia's developmental testing facilities, which were in place largely to support nuclear weapons development programs. I took on that responsibility, and three months later, the Soviet Union collapsed. And for those people in the national security apparatus, what that meant is the enemy was gone. Peace dividend was declared. All advanced phase weapons programs, nuclear weapons programs, were canceled summarily. What that meant to me as a brand new director over this mammoth testing empire was my customer base was down by about 75%. And I had huge, huge fixed infrastructure costs. $100 million up. Fixed infrastructure costs. And because it was operated as an internal service center, it meant that if I didn't have customers, I didn't have any money to run this testing empire. So that was my introduction into hard decisions, really, really hard decisions, benchmarking against who else can provide these capabilities. Business cases around, do I dismantle or mothball? If I need to reconstitute, what does it take? What does it look like? Can I ever stop testing at places? Because if you stop using facilities, it triggers something in the code about environmental remediation. And so there were all of these factors that nothing in my background prepared me for. But it literally was a trial by fire. I did that for about 3 years. It wasn't exactly what I thought about when I got my bright, shiny degrees in electrical engineering. But it was an introduction to really hard choices and problem solving. Under some pretty significant constraints. I went from that to what I would sometimes term a fluff job. It was director level, but it was almost an ambassador for a strategic initiative at the lab called Advanced Information Technologies. And my job was to go around across all of the line organizations, make myself smart on what they were doing, go out and look for collaborative partners. In universities and industry, as well as some other laboratories. So it's a bit of a matchmaker. I was supposed to sort of build a strategic vision of where Sandia could set itself apart in advanced information technologies, and then build programs and partnerships. This was my introduction to leadership with responsibility and no authority. Because I owned no resources. So it was an opportunity, I will say, to hone my skills on persuasion and influencing without any consequences if they blew me off. So it was another aspect of leadership. But it was really great fun. It was really quite rewarding because it causes you to think about what's in it for them. And to be able to articulate a value proposition so that they want to play. And I would say within 9 months to a year, they were actively spotting potential partners and having working with me to build the kinds of relationships. So all in all, it was really a very rewarding, particularly after the job before. It was a rewarding experience, but it also kind of opened my aperture by getting me more networked outside Sandia Laboratory. So when the next opportunity, this is sort of one of those other forks, I was really pretty happy at Sandia Labs because it was lots of opportunities for an engineer. But I got a call one day from the president of the lab, who had gotten a call from John Deutsch, who was then the director of Central Intelligence. John had just been appointed to that position and was looking outside to find a new head for science and technology at CIA. This was the deputy director for science and technology. And so John, being John, went to his colleagues who ran various laboratories and said, send me your candidates. So one day he brought all of the candidates that had been nominated in. We all spent a full day interviewing with John and with others in the CIA. And at the end of the day, I went back in to see John, and he basically offered me the job. And I was pretty taken aback because I knew nothing about intelligence. I mean, nothing. And I also wasn't very sure that my husband was going to like the thought of relocating from our nice custom-built house that we had designed in the mountains outside Albuquerque to Washington. So I told John I needed to go home and talk to my husband and give it some thought. He says, okay, today's Friday. Give me a call on Monday, and if you're interested, I'll bring you back and we'll talk some more. So we negotiated a deal where if I took the job, it would be as a two-year temporary assignment, so an IPA, interagency personnel assignment, from Sandia to the CIA. And I persuaded my husband that 2 years can't be bad. So on Monday, I called John and said, I'm interested, let's talk some more. He says, when can you start? That was his idea of talking more. So packed up, moved to Washington. It was such a spooky experience. My introduction to the CIA when I came back for the interview was hilarious. They put me up in Crystal City and said, just take a taxi to get to headquarters, because I said, I don't know how to get there. And they said, well, just ask the taxi driver, because they didn't have an address. They have a P.O. box, not an address. I said, well, just ask the taxi driver. He'll know where we are. And I'm thinking, okay, what a strange way to find a place. The first taxi driver didn't, but the next one did. So I thought, this is a very strange agency, and that was the tip of the iceberg. But that experience, working inside the CIA, working on science and technology, made me see another side of the national security apparatus with which I had had no prior experience. And again, opened my eyes to several new frames of reference. One of the things I used to tell my colleagues at the labs was, you know, we worked on precision guidance systems, and we could pinpoint the landing spot of anything precisely. I mean, we were really good at that. It wasn't until I got to the intelligence community that I realized the problem was defining the spot, because we weren't so good at that. A lot of ambiguity in that community. But my job as head of science and technology was to equip two sides of the agency. One was the analytics side. This was in an era where they were still equipped with Lotus Notes and no internet connectivity. And my job was to try to build analytic tools that would do their job a little more effectively. I also equipped the operations side with some interesting gadgets. Think Q. In fact, in my going away party, they gave me a T-shirt with a whole alphabet on the front with a big Q in the middle. But it's that kind of stuff that we did. I also had the opportunity, though, to travel to 24 countries. Now, admittedly, most of what I saw were airports and embassies, but I also had an opportunity to meet with government officials from many countries, and I saw us through their eyes in many of those conversations, and it was illuminating. It was sobering, too. But it again gave me a set of experiences that, had I had a career path planned, I would never have gained those kinds of experiences. Getting that global perspective on what's happening was really very educational. Having spent 20-plus years in the national security apparatus, it's just, it was phenomenally educational. So the job was, on the one hand, enormously rewarding because we had people, we were supporting missions that meant lives. They meant national level decisions. It was really heady stuff in terms of a feeling of making a difference for the country. It was, all of that was on the positive side of the ledger. The other side of the ledger was the tougher part. I came into the agency in 1995, and the entire community and most of the national security apparatus had been on a 5-year glide path. The declaration of the peace dividend with the collapse of the Soviet Union caused them to shrink budgets, to shrink staff through attrition. And what that meant was there had been almost no hiring for 5 years. Now, in that time was also when the World Wide Web was taking off exponentially, reshaping the information environment, causing societal changes all over the world, including in the US. And the community that I was a part of was poorly equipped, let me just say, poorly equipped to deal with that change, because we didn't have the fresh blood. The apparatus is cloistered behind very tall walls, so the dialogues that did occur with people outside those walls were with the trusted partners that had been thoroughly vetted over decades before. And even though my organization at the CIA was very, very large in terms of headcount, it was not deep in terms of the technical talent that was needed to operate in that world. So it was enormously challenging, and the exposure to trying to effect change inside the government during that time was, again, both honing and stressing every skill that I brought to the table. Two quick anecdotes on that. One is I had a team of just really sharp people that worked with me to build a multimedia presentation that we termed the Agile Intelligence Enterprise. And it was on the analytics side. And it basically was scenario-based, and it hypothesized an environment in which I could authenticate myself to the system. The system then knew, the system being the information system, knew what data I should have access to, would flag if I tried to gain access to something that I shouldn't have access to. It knew what data existed that might be of value to me, and if I didn't have access, it would send the owner of that data a note saying, look, I know the profile. So the point is, it's not the details. The point is, it was a sort of a 15-year vision of what an agile intelligence enterprise could look like. Data finding data, people finding people, collaborative networks forming and disbanding, and so forth. I gave that presentation at least 100 times. At least 100 times. Everybody loved it, and absolutely nothing happened. And a part of it was because I was at one agency, and the intelligence community was anything but a community. So to effect this vision meant working as a community, so building relationships across boundaries. And that wasn't going to happen. And the most sobering piece of this was post 9/11, the 9/11 Commission staff came to visit me, and they said, "We keep hearing about this thing called the Agile Intelligence Enterprise. What is it?" And I gave them a thumbnail sketch. And they said, "Well, that's exactly." Well, the problem was that conversation was a decade after we originally started talking about it, and still nothing had happened. So it was kind of an introduction to how difficult it is to effect wide-scale change, because this isn't, unfortunately, one of my lessons was you have to figure out how to make a wide-scale vision digestible in small-scale chunks. And I didn't have that mastered, so it didn't take off. And frankly, progress has been made since then, but it's still not at the scale that I would like. The other observation I made was the partners, the science and technology partners of the community at that time, were their long-term trusted contractors, but they had almost no relationships with the IT industry that was driving innovation during the 90s. So change was happening very, very rapidly outside their community. And it was very hard to do the matchmaking, because the impedance mismatch between the very, very secretive intelligence apparatus and the IT industry that was global and moving at the speed of light, literally, was huge. And so late in my tenure, we got together a small group and proposed creation of what we termed, first of all, a halfway house. It was to be a place where mission folks and innovators could come together around problems, and the innovators could learn enough about the mission to understand how they could bring tools to the fore, and the mission folks would learn enough about the tools to know what to ask for, because that was a part of it. They couldn't even talk to each other, because the mission folks could describe how they would do what they're already doing, but do it electronically. But they couldn't really envision beyond that. So it was trying to figure out a way to break down that wall. What was actually created was what is today InQtel, which is a bit of a different beast, but it has the seeds of the notion, which is building a bridge between startup community in particular and the mission. And solutions have migrated in over the past decade. There have been some marvelous successes in that regard, but it's still difficult to break down those barriers. So the 3 years I spent inside was very, very educational, very energizing. After leaving that, it was another of those forks in the road where I got a phone call from a headhunter, and he said, "We'd like for you to interview for this position. It's a CEO job, and I can't tell you the name of the company, but I'm sure you'd recognize it." Well, I didn't. When he finally did tell me the name, it was a company. It was a 501c3, which is a not-for-profit organization that had flown largely under the radar, working mostly for the Air Force, doing studies and analysis of all kinds, from technical requirements. Its heritage was actually looking at R&D programs, acquisition programs, technical analyses. And for whatever miracle, the Board of Trustees decided to break with tradition, and they offered me the job. It's a company that is 55 years old, and I'm only its fourth CEO. So they have a pretty long tradition of keeping people in place. And again, it has been a wonderful learning experience, but it's truly one of those, you know, where the buck stops, because every failure is yours and every success is somebody else's. But that's, again, that's part, I think, of being a leader, is you have to own the failures, the problems. But the team gets the credit for everything good that happens, and that's as it should be. The company has changed a lot. I've also had other opportunities that I'll touch on very briefly, because I really want to shut up and see if you have questions. In 2002, I was elected into the National Academy of Engineering, and that was an opportunity. I mean, in one regard, it was an honor to have been elected, but it brought me into another community of the National Academies and the National Research Council. And I've been on a number of studies. I've led a number of studies. Currently, trying to wrap up one that's looking at the implications of globalization of science and technology for the Department of Defense. So again, it's been one of those sets of experiences that have allowed me to look very, very broadly and build networks of relationships and build an understanding that actually informs every decision that I make, because it gives me a different context of understanding. I won't say I make great decisions all the time, but I think that they are better informed because of the experiences in working with the National Academies. So it has been an interesting road, not done yet, but it certainly was not where I thought I was headed when I entered college. And it was all, in my mind, it was all about grabbing the opportunities as they presented themselves. Some of those were pretty scary at the time. But looking back, I don't regret having taken on anything that I did. With that, I'd like to shut up and say, do you all have any questions? Ralph?
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about the difference between the leadership role when you have people directly reporting to you and then when you don't, and using persuasion. A little bit of a different spin. How about your experience and what is important when you move from an organization that you can see everybody and touch everybody and to a scale that you can't see and touch everybody? How does the leadership change? And then the ultimate of that is then managing and leading executives. Yeah. How does that?
Those are hugely different things, because again, your leadership team become your surrogates. And building, and this is where, again, chunking a vision and making it digestible is really very important. And having, I will say, having feedback loops is also very important. When I was at the agency, CIA, there was no way to touch field. It was huge. And even where I am today, I can't. But I do every month have a CEO breakfast with staff just to hear their unadulterated views of what's going on. And I learn a lot, and my leadership team hates it. not entirely. But so it's, you've got to maintain that connection. But you also have to build the relationships with your executive team and have candid enough dialogues to say, are we operating on the same page? Actually, it's interesting because one of the frustrations that we're having right now is we, like others, do a plan, but it's not the document, it's the planning process. So we've been struggling to find a visualization tool, because we have corporate goals, objectives, strategies, and then we have group strategies, activities, and measures. And I wanted to see graphically the connective tissue from top to bottom. And it turns out that most strategic plans that I see examples of, it's hierarchy. So the fan out is fairly contained. we took a systems perspective and found all of these interdependencies. And so now, trying to visualize that, because our challenge is telling the person at the desk how what they're doing matters to this goal. And so getting that storyline, and I've got one of my guys exploring visualization tools because I desperately want to do that. But candidly, it's not just the person at the desk. It's also the executive team, because we have found gaps in what we were doing in some of our newer areas just because we didn't force that alignment. And it's causing us to have different kinds of conversations as a team. Some things are being thrown off the life raft because we simply can't do it all. But it is a different style of leadership. I will say that it's a struggle some days not to feel like you're losing touch with the work of the people. So one of the things we do, for example, at every Board of Trustees meeting, which is quarterly, we have some of our young analysts come present to the board. They love it. I love it. It's just exciting because they're on the front lines doing the hard work.
What personal characteristics would you look for in a person who would be taking a job like yours eventually, or for that matter, when you look at yourself, what would you say are your nature of your character which has led to this success in these various endeavors?
I'm probably not the best to judge, but I'll give you a bias, which is I grew up on a farm in Kansas. We didn't have much. We developed a work ethic right from the start that was very, very important. I had a grounding in my parents and community about integrity and ethics and dealing with others. That I think was also very, very important, respect. So, I mean, those are some of the things. I also, though, believe being passionate about what you're doing is really important, because most days it's caring about what I'm doing is the only thing that keeps me doing it, because there is a level of frustration that otherwise, you know, you tilt at windmills for so long sometimes that it's very frustrating. But the sense of what drives me is wanting to make a difference. And as long as I feel like I'm making a difference, then it motivates me. So I would look for somebody who cares a lot about the outcome, not just about the work, but the outcome, because I think that will trump a lot of other things. And then I want somebody, it's interesting, one of the courses I took very early in my managerial career was on the art of thinking, and it had styles of thinking, everything from synthesis to analyst to pragmatist, idealist, realist, I think, five styles of thinking. I put that to good use because it allows me to, over time, figure out how other people are thinking. So it's not only knowing what style of thinking I use most often, but the course in that says, okay, if you're dealing with this kind of a person, these are the kinds of arguments you need to make. So people who are adept at changing the way they address diverse groups, I think, is another attribute. If you say it's my way is the only way, I don't think you get very far. Because on virtually any team, you will have a diversity of perspectives. People just think differently. And so there is no one-size message that's going to work across that group. Other questions? Yeah.
You have noticed in the patterns like real life lessons that you learned through your life being in the leadership. Is there something that you said, like, you know what, having that one learned in school as part of my master's education, like a little bit more about it, would have helped me a lot in addition to not replacing the real life lessons, but that would say, like, that would have been really an important skills.
Yeah, I won't argue that the lessons that I learned are unique. They're probably on lists and in books, and I've read a lot of books on leadership principles. But it's putting them in context with real people that cements the lesson, in my view. And that's the difference. I think you can, look, I have a library full of books on leadership. I've read them all, and each one gives me a little bit different idea about the way to deal with certain situations. But I think it's in real life you synthesize what you've read, what you've learned, and say, okay, they never quite have the precise situation that you're facing. Never. So it's that real life that causes you to synthesize what you've picked up and put it into practice. And even these lessons you have to tweak with the situation. So, you know, my lessons are not unique, but I have the battle scars. Yeah.
What kinds of challenges did you face being a woman in throughout your career, especially in many male-dominated fields?
Yeah, they were all male-dominated. Actually, one of the most painful was actually when I was at Wichita State University. And I wouldn't have known, but my major advisor was so furious. It turns out another professor was determined that I would not get an A in his course. So he changed his curve. He had always graded 92 and above was an A, and he changed it for one semester so that I wouldn't get an A. And that, you know, I didn't even know how to deal with it. These days, people would just go ballistic over that. But I wouldn't have even known it, but my major advisor was just furious. Furious. Now, looking back, I would have said, why the heck didn't you do something? But so that was a jolt. I will say the, you know, working at the Nevada test site, I was the only female, absolutely the only female. But we built such camaraderie as a team that within our team, it was not an issue. It was the experimenters who didn't quite know how to deal with it. You have to envision these big, huge tunnels going a mile into the mountain, and they have these little minor car trains that if you're lucky, you can get hitch a ride in. Well, the miners would always stop for me. So the guys learned, let's walk in with Ruth, because they'll stop and we'll get a ride. So there were those kinds of things. And the other really amusing thing was we were working literally around the clock, and I would be in the alcove, in the tunnel, alone, in the middle of the night, you know, 2, 3, 4 a.m., and the miners started checking on me. So it was this. It was kind of an interesting dynamic. There's no guy they would have checked on. So those kinds of things were certainly because I was female. But it was just kind of interesting. There have been places where, you know, there's been overt, not hostility, but just why are you here? And I just kind of developed a thick skin and said that's their problem. You know, that's their problem. I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm just going to do my job. That's their problem. Because I think to try to make an issue of it can exacerbate the situation. At least the era in which I grew up as an engineer, because it was all male dominated. It was a very different environment. Other questions? Yeah.
I'd just like to follow up with that. Then, based on the expansion of your career, then how is it different, or is it different today, from your perspective and your position?
Oh, I think there are clear differences. You see, there were no female faculty members in engineering, none, when I was in college. There were, sadly, the percentage of female students hasn't gone up as much as I would like. But there are more than there were at that time. In the workplace, there are a lot more female technical professionals. It varies a lot by field, but there simply are a lot more. And there is much broader acceptance, I think, of females in these areas. Other questions?
Did you find any use for or value in professional societies?
I did. I should have mentioned that actually. Throughout my career at Sandia, I was a member of IEEE and some of the sub-societies to that. I was Eta Kappa Nu, Tau Beta Pi, those sorts of things. But when I came to Washington, I kind of got out of that. And subsequently, the national academies have become the surrogate for professional societies. So, yes, I did find great value in those societies. Other questions? Okay, I've overstayed my welcome. We're losing our audience. Thank you.
We have something here to remind you of your evening with us.
Oh, thank you. Ooh, that's marvelous.
Thank you.
That's true. Thank you.
Thanks.
That's gorgeous. That's gorgeous. Ooh.
Please join us outside. We have a little reception set up, and if you want to caucus with Ruth in the atrium, that would be great.